Chapter 38.
"I can see you like pigs," said Mr. Worley as I edged my way into the pen.
"You can?"
"Oh, yes, I can always tell. As soon as you went in there, nice and quiet, and scratched Queenie's back and spoke to her, I said, 'There's a young man as likes pigs.'"
"Oh, good. Well, as a matter of fact, you're absolutely right. I do like pigs."
I had, in truth, been creeping very cautiously past Queenie, wondering just how she was going to react. She was a huge animal, and sows with litters can be very hostile to strangers. When I had come into the building, she had got up from where she was suckling her piglets and eyed me with a non-committal grunt, reminding me of the number of times I had left the pig pen a lot quicker than I had gone in. A big, barking, gaping-mouthed sow had always been able to make me move very smartly. Now that I was right inside the narrow pen, Queenie seemed to have accepted me. She grunted again, but peaceably, then carefully collapsed on the straw and exposed her udder to the eager little mouths. When she was in this position, I was able to examine her foot.
"Aye, that's the one," Mr. Worley said anxiously. "She could hardly hobble when she got up this morning."
There didn't seem to be much wrong. A flap of the horn of one claw was a bit overgrown and was rubbing on the sensitive sole, but we didn't usually get called out for little things like that. I cut away the overgrown part and dressed the sore place with our multi-purpose ointment, ung, pini, sedativum, while all the time Mr. Worley knelt by Queenie's head and patted her and sort of crooned into her ear. I couldn't make out the words he used. Maybe it was pig language because the sow really seemed to be answering him with little, soft grunts. Anyway, it worked better than an anesthetic, and everybody was happy, including the long row of piglets working busily at the double line of teats.
"Right, Mr. Worley."
I straightened up and handed him the jar of ung pini. "Keep rubbing in a little of that twice a day, and I think she'll be sound in no time."
"Thank ye. Thank ye, I'm very grateful."
He shook my hand vigorously as though I had saved the animal's life.
"I'm very glad to meet you for the first time, Miss Harriet. I've known Mr. Farnham for a year or two, of course, and I think a bit about him. Loves pigs, does that man. Loves them. And his young brother's been here once or twice. I reckon he's fond of pigs, too."
"Devoted to them, Mr. Worley."
"Ah, yes, I thought so. I can always tell."
He regarded me for a while with a moist eye, then smiled, well satisfied. We went out into what was really the backyard of an inn, because Mr. Worley wasn't a regular farmer. He was the landlord of the Langthorpe Falls Hotel, and his precious livestock were crammed into what had once been the stables and coach houses of the inn. They were all Tamworths, and whichever door you opened, you found yourself staring into the eyes of ginger-haired pigs. There were a few porkers and the odd one being fattened for bacon, but Mr. Worley's prize was his sows. He had six of them: Queenie, Princess, Ruby, Marigold, Delilah, and Primrose. For years, expert farmers had been assuring Mr. Worley that he'd never do any good with his sows. If you were going in for breeding, they said, you had to have proper premises. It wasn't a bit of use shoving sows into converted buildings like his. And for years, Mr. Worley's sows had responded by producing litters of unprecedented size and raising them with tender care. They were all good mothers and didn't savage their families or crush them clumsily under their bodies, so it turned out with uncanny regularity that at the end of 8 weeks, Mr. Worley had around 12 chunky wieners to take to market. It must have spoiled the farmer's beer. None of them could equal that. And the pill was all the more bitter because the landlord had come from the industrial West Riding. Halifax, I think it was. A frail, short-sighted little retired newsagent with no agricultural background. By all the laws, he just didn't have a chance. Leaving the yard, we came onto the quiet loop of road where my car was parked. Just beyond, the road dipped steeply into a tree-lined ravine, where the Darrow hurled itself over a great, broken shelf of rock in its passage to the lower dale. I couldn't see down from where I was standing, but I could hear the faint roar of the water,
and could picture the black cliff lifting sheer from the boiling river, and on the other bank the gentle slope of turf, where people from the towns came to sit and look in wonder. Some of them were here now. A big, shiny car had drawn up, and its occupants were disembarking. The driver, sleek, fat and impressive, strolled towards us and called out, "We would like some tea." Mr. Worley swung round on them. "And you can have some, mister, but when I'm ready. I've some very important business with this gentleman." He turned his back on the man and began to ask me for final instructions about Queenie's foot. The man was obviously taken aback, and I couldn't blame him. It seemed to me that Mr. Worley might have shown a little more tact. After all, serving food and drink was his living. But as I came to know him better, I realized that his pigs came first, and everything else was an irritating intrusion. Knowing Mr. Worley better had its rewards. The time when I feel most like a glass of beer is not in the evening when the pubs are open, but at around 4:30 on a hot afternoon after wrestling with young cattle in some stifling cowshed. It was delightful to retire, sweating and weary, to the shaded sanctuary of Mr. Worley's back kitchen, and sip at the bitter ale, cool, frothing, straight from the cellar below.